I'm Tom Hall. It's a leap year. It's leap day. It's Maryland morning. Tomorrow is Super Tuesday, and we'll use our extra day to ponder how the political divide in America has become so pronounced. If a series of victories tomorrow establishes Donald Trump as the standard bearer for the Republican Party, does that mean that the political polarity of the Obama years gets even worse? In his new book, Why the Right Went Wrong, acclaimed political journalist E.J. Dionne contends that reforming American conservatism is one of the most important tasks of our time. He'll join me to offer his unique perspective on the body politic in this political high season. Plus, filmmaker Alan Moore on his latest documentary about a group of men trying to find and to redefine themselves. And theater critic J. Wynn Russick has a review of the Antigone Project at Columbia's Rep Stage. Politics with E.J. Dionne coming right up after the news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Good morning, everybody. Hope you had a great weekend. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1 WIPR, and this is Maryland Morning. Happy Leap Day. As you have no doubt heard, Super Tuesday is tomorrow. Voters will determine Democrat and Republican primary and caucus winners in a dozen states in this unprecedented election cycle. On the Republican side, we have an establishment that is terrified at the prospect of Donald Trump being the standard bearer of its party, and a primary electorate that is more engaged and perhaps more outraged than ever before. For the Dems, Hillary Clinton is riding the wave of a big victory in South Carolina on Saturday. After tomorrow, there are five more states on the election docket next weekend. My guest this morning is eminently qualified to give us perspective on these primaries and the factors that have, over the last 70 years, contributed to an ever-intensifying political polarity. E.J. Dionne is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a syndicated columnist for The Washington Post, and a professor at Georgetown University. His latest book is a terrific analysis of how the conservative movement has evolved since the 1960s. It's called Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. E.J. Dionne joins me from the studios of NPR in Washington. Morning, E.J. How you doing?
Good morning, Tom. Thanks so much, and happy leap day to you.
Happy leap day as well.
What a great idea that is.
Indeed. Well, and we are taking all sorts of leaps. I'm not sure they're going in the direction of forward in this political season.
Well said.
You know, the main thesis of your book, or at least in part, is that the common wisdom has been that the right became radicalized because of the election of Barack Obama. But you're saying that that's really not a correct analysis, that this steady progression to the right and the radicalization of the right has been going on for some time.
Right. That's exactly it. The first sentence of my book is the history of contemporary American conservatism is a story of disappointment and betrayal. And what I argue in the book is that ever since Barry Goldwater was nominated in 1964 and conservatives took over the Republican Party, Republican politicians have had to make a series of promises that they couldn't possibly keep, that they'd reduce the size of government radically. Well, government was the same size when Ronald Reagan left office as when he took office, when you measure it as a share of GDP. And that was true of all the other Republican presidents since, Nixon and both Bushes. There is a promise to roll back the cultural changes in the country to kind of bring us back to the 1950s. That's not possible either. And of late, there's been a promise, if you will, to restore the ethnic makeup of the country back to where it was in 1940. Well, that's not going to happen. And even if Donald Trump promises to deport 11 million people and build a wall that Mexico will pay for. But the failure to keep these promises has created this cycle of radicalization that has led us to this day where Donald Trump is the favorite in the primaries on Tuesday. There's another factor I talk about a lot, which is that the Republican Party has relied on the votes of white working class voters for decades and has really delivered no material benefits to them. And this isn't just a liberal like me saying this. In the book, I quote people like Ross Douthat, the conservative columnist for The New York Times, or Raihan Salam, a conservative intellectual. And they wrote a book together that talked about the party of Sam's Club. It's a phrase of Governor Tim Pawlenty. And those voters really have gotten very little. Donald Trump is their revenge, and Trump is leading a kind of class war inside the Republican Party.
There are a lot of Democrats who either surreptitiously or overtly are somewhat delighted that the Republicans have gotten themselves to this point. And you know, as you say, a self-avowed progressive and liberal, but you say that reforming American conservatism is really one of the most important tasks of our time. Why is that?
In the short term, obviously, a lot of Democrats are delighted. I just saw a poll this morning by CNN, which shows Trump way ahead nationally among Republicans. But the same poll shows that 35% of Republicans said they would definitely not vote for him. On the Democratic side, the comparable number is 20%. Who said they would definitely not vote for Hillary Clinton. Now, both those numbers may be a little high in the heat of the primary, but that shows the problems Republicans and conservatives confront with a Trump nomination. So you can see why Democrats are and liberals are kind of gleeful. But I argue that the all-Democratic, small-d Democratic polities need a responsible conservative movement. And I think that when you look at what's happened over the last, say, 20 years, the move of the Republican Party to the right is much greater than the move of the Democratic Party to the left. I cite a lot of numbers on this, as well as some great work by my friends Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein. But just to, you know, give an example of that, only about 35 to 40% of Democrats think of themselves as liberal. Back in 2014, it was 34%. It's probably up to about 40% now, but that means that 60% of Democrats are something else. On the other hand, in the Republican Party, 67% call themselves conservative, about half of them very conservative. And with this radicalized Republican Party and conservative movement, governing is really impossible because the nature of the anti-government ideology that Republicans have to keep repeating, even if they can't enact it, means that there can't be any compromise between the two parties. And so the total breakdown in governing that you've seen in the last several years, I think can and should be attributed in large part to this radicalization in the GOP. If I can just give one example of that, as recently as 2008, plenty of Republicans acknowledged that climate change was a problem. John McCain introduced a bill with Joe Lieberman to deal with it. A lot of Republicans said, look, we don't want some complicated cap and trade system, but we're willing to go with some kind of carbon tax that would be market friendly and maybe give the money back to people some other way. Now, it is an article of faith in the party that you have to deny climate change. That's one of many issues in which this radicalization is making it impossible to have a debate over how liberals and conservatives or left and right might solve discrete problems.
E.J. Dionne Jr., his new book is called Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. E.J., you write about a book written way back in 1967 by Lloyd Free and Hadley Cantrell, in which they identified Americans as ideological conservatives, but operational liberals. You bring up the example, for example, of when President Bush, George W. Bush, proposed redesigning Social Security and that went down in flames. And you even remind us that Barry Goldwater suggested privatization of Social Security many years prior to that. I wonder, do you think, first of all, that it's still true that we're ideologically conservative but operationally liberal? And if so, I wonder in a weird way if that doesn't play into the hands of a Donald Trump. I mean, the people who try to attack him on policy in the Republican Party are saying he's too far to the left. Is Trump the epitome of, this era's paradigm of ideological conservatism but operational liberalism?
That's a very shrewd observation on your part. I'm really glad you brought up Free and Cantrell because that was a seminal finding all those years ago. And their point is that Americans in the abstract are often very critical of government, and government makes mistakes. Government can abuse its power. I think that's something people across the political spectrum are wary of. But when it comes down to programs, Americans actually want quite a lot from government. In the book, I note that Tea Party supporters, who are always talking about shrinking government, say over and over, but we don't want to cut Medicare and Social Security. Now, the rationale is usually that, well, these are earned benefits, unlike the stuff that goes to those freeloaders. But the fact is that Tea Partiers, the majority of them, are near at or over the age of 65, and they don't want to give up those benefits. If you don't want to cut Social Security and Medicare, and you don't want to cut national defense, there isn't a whole lot of government left to cut. And it goes on from there. People might say, we don't really like intrusive regulation, but they sure want the government to protect their air and their water, as the whole mess in Flint, Michigan, the horrible mess in Flint, Michigan, reminds us. You're quite right about Trump being a hybrid. On the one hand, he is, if you will, very right-wing on issues like immigration, banning Muslims from the United States. Some of what he said about race, his kind of strange reluctance this weekend to back away from the KKK. He finally apparently said it this morning that he condemns the David Duke and the Klan. So you've got that right-wing part of him. But on the other hand, you've got the part of him that says that he wouldn't cut Social Security and Medicare, that he even endorsed negotiating for prescription drug costs to lower them, negotiating with the drug companies, which is a Democratic position. And he's been more critical in some ways, or at least used language more critical of President Bush on the Iraq war than many Democrats have been willing to do. In an odd way, Trump looks most like the European far right, this mixture of xenophobia and anti-immigrant feeling on the one hand and economic nationalism on the other. I should add, Trump is very critical of trade agreements. And I thought it was quite revealing this weekend that Jean-Marie Le Pen, the leader of the far right National Front Party in France, said that he supports Donald Trump. I haven't heard anybody ask him to sort of say what he Trump thought of that endorsement. So, yes, Trump is crosswise to our political system. And in some ways, if you associate him with the European far right, in some fairly scary ways.
Well, it's interesting. If Mr. Trump has never heard of David Duke, I wonder if he's even heard of Monsieur Le Pen. But
it was odd that he said he hadn't heard of David Duke when a couple of days earlier he had renounced his support. So there's something peculiar going on there.
All right. E.J. Dion is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a syndicated columnist for the Washington Post, a professor at Georgetown University. His new book is called Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. We'll have more with E.J. Dion after this break for the news. Stay with us. Here's Nathan.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
And welcome back to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. As you know, Super Tuesday is tomorrow here in Maryland. In just 8 weeks, on April 26th, we'll be casting presidential primary votes, along with votes for mayor and other local offices, the Congress and the Senate. My guest this morning is E.J. Dion, the syndicated columnist of the Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. We're talking about politics and political history. E.J.'s new book is terrific. It's a terrific, insightful, trenchant read, and I recommend it without hesitation. It's called Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. So another book, E.J., that you reference in your book is written by George Gilder and Bruce Chapman after LBJ had a huge landslide victory over Barry Goldwater in 64. It's called The Party That Lost Its Head. Of course, last week, Lindsey Graham sort of put that a little more vividly. What is this? We talk about the Republican establishment, which is fearful of a Trump nomination. Who is the Republican establishment? I mean, are there names and faces we can attach to that establishment? And is this all their fault? Is it Rice Priebus? I mean, who is it?
That's great. It's too bad that we're very polite on NPR, which I approve of, that we can't fully quote Lindsey Graham from last week. Although these days, when you look, by the way, at the insulting tone over the last several days between Trump and Rubio, I can't believe that there aren't a lot of people out there, including a lot of Republicans, who say, has our politics come to this? I wonder if there's some blowback on that, again, inside the Republican Party as much as anywhere else. But yeah, I'm really glad you quoted that old book, which I still love. It's interesting that George Gilder and Bruce Chapman, who were then liberal Republicans bemoaning what Barry Goldwater had done to their party, later themselves became quite conservative. George Gilder became a hero of supply-side economics. On this question of Republican establishment, it's a term that I think increasingly lacks meaning for a number of reasons. I mean, I think when we use it, we kind of think of the Republican congressional leadership and the old line donors as opposed to the new, what David Frum, the maverick conservative, calls the radical rich, the Koch brothers and people like that. That's who we think of. But I don't think there is a single Republican establishment anymore. You have a lot of right and far right groups that have a lot of influence through, for example, talk radio. Rush Limbaugh, who set off a slew of imitators across the AM dial starting in the late 1980s. You obviously also have the rise of Fox News. And then you have these alternative conservative institutions, the Heritage Foundation now, which has become increasingly a political rather than an, a political operation rather than a think tank. All these groups are an alternative source of power in the Republican Party. And I think the leaders, such as they were, lost control. But I think there's something else that's gone on, which is the leaders largely ceded power to these groups and indeed used them for their own purposes. In the book, I talk about how John Boehner really wouldn't speak back to the birthers or to those who said that President Obama was a Muslim, putting aside the fact that we're a free country and Muslims should be free to be president, too. And I think they played a game with the far right, figuring we'll use their energy in midterm elections, but we can keep them under control. And the quotation that's been occurring to me a lot lately is from John F. Kennedy's inaugural address, where he said that he who foolishly rides to power on the back of the tiger usually ends up inside. And a lot of the Republican establishment has kind of ended up inside. Boehner had to resign. Eric Cantor was defeated in a primary. Kevin McCarthy was blocked from becoming speaker. And now the Republican leadership, having acquiesced to the moderates either being thrown out of their party in primaries or and to the defection of many, many moderate Republicans from the party, now look around and say, how do we stop Trump or Ted Cruz? And the votes are gone. And I think they were complicit in a lot of this. And I talk about that in the book.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, E.J. Dionne. His book is called Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. I wonder, having traced this progression from Goldwater through the Tea Party and now to Trump, there are a lot of people who say, you know, the Republicans made this bed and now they've got to sleep in it. You say at one point in the book that for Republican leaders, Trump was a genius until he wasn't. Is Trump's rise here and prominence in the primaries, at least? I mean, he showed that he's got the capacity to earn tens of thousands of votes. Whether he can earn tens of millions of votes, I suppose, remains to be seen. But is this a logical progression? Does Trump make sense given what's been going on in the previous 50 or 60 years?
Well, first of all, let's look back to Trump's days as a birther. Early in the Obama administration, I mean, Trump is not an accident. He didn't just appear on the scene. He had been working the far right of the Republican Party for years. And when he was saying all these outlandish things about Obama and his birth certificate and all of that, Republican leaders welcomed him. And in the book, I sort of have that moment when Donald Trump endorsed Mitt Romney. Now Mitt Romney is out there trying to stop Trump. But when Trump endorsed Mitt Romney, He praised him in terms that were very Trumpian. He talked about his skill as a businessman. He said he was deeply honored to have Donald Trump's support. So as long as Trump was out there as somebody who riled up and mobilized the Republican far right, the Republicans were perfectly happy to have him out there. It was only when Trump said, hey, I want to run the whole show, that they are saying, well, gee, that's not exactly what we had in mind back then. And so, yes, he does have a peculiar genius. I also think that he has an incredible sense of where people are weak, and he strikes at that weakness. You know, Jeb Bush's decline, I think, was brought about in significant part by Donald Trump. Although one of the arguments I make in the book, and I'm not surprised that Jeb fell, is when we look at the Tea Party sentiment, it really began to show itself not when Barack Obama was elected, but at the end of George W. Bush's administration. A lot of conservatives turned on Bush when he was seen as an unsuccessful president. But instead of sort of blaming Bush's problems on Katrina or on the Iraq War, their argument was, well, he was too liberal. He was too much of a big government Republican. And a lot of that stuck to Jeb Bush. So even when he was riding high, he already had a lot of problems on the right wing of the party. And Trump knew that and exploited those troubles.
It's interesting to me that they did embrace Trump for the longest time, yet another person who is in many ways very politically similar, Ted Cruz, they've never embraced. I mean, in 2013, Cruz leads another shutdown of the government over the repeal of Obamacare. He got very little support from the party. They had realized how disastrous previous shutdowns had been, but they didn't really support him. He was kind of left standing. It's widely known that he doesn't seem to be very well liked by anybody in the Senate. Why is it that Trump got embraced and a guy like Cruz did not?
Well, Trump is not, on the whole, embraced by party leaders any more than Cruz is. He's picking up some support now. Obviously, Chris Christie, who has to kind of eat a lot of words, he said about Trump, and Senator Jeff Sessions just endorsed him. Trump doesn't have a lot of institutional support either. Cruz was seen as somebody inside the Senate who would do anything, even if it were harmful to the party, to advance his own interest. And I joke in the book that, you know, for one senator to criticize another as ambitious is kind of odd, since every member of the Senate at one point or another seems to think he or she should be president of the United States. But I think Cruz did it in a way that was rather naked, with no respect for the other members. A lot of senators think that Cruz knew that the whole shutdown strategy would fail, but also knew that this would give him a lot of prominence. I've joked with a lot of my conservative friends that if there were a secret ballot to be leader of the Senate, and the only two candidates were the Democratic leader Harry Reid and Ted Cruz, Harry Reid would win either 99-1 or 98-2, depending on what Ted Cruz's friend Mike Lee did in the secret ballot. So there is something about Ted Cruz that turns off the party, but he has gotten pretty far on this opposition. I mean, he looks like he will win his home state of Texas, and it's probably best positioned to give Trump a run in the states of the Deep South.
You know, looking ahead, as people are now making their political calculations, as Governor Christie has done, and fully embracing and endorsing Trump, I wonder if you think perhaps it's very possible, because he's been roundly denounced for doing this. Meg Whitman, his own former finance chair, it was a stunning disavowal of Governor Christie on Sunday, where she called it an act of political opportunism and urged everybody to not support either Christie or Trump. Do you think that Christie and anybody else, a few others in the political establishment, have endorsed Trump now? Do you think that they will suffer the same fate that, I don't know, perhaps McCain suffered when he chose Sarah Palin to be his running mate?
Well, I don't know what Christie is playing for. I mean, it's very clear that Christie did not like Marco Rubio at all, and he really sort of tore him apart. I sometimes think that maybe Jeb Bush should have offered Christie the Secretary of State's job just to keep him in for a couple more debates, because that was a real demolition job Christie did on Rubio, and he's continuing that on the campaign trail, he also dislikes Ted Cruz. The interesting question is, why did he go with Trump instead of John Kasich, who on paper would seem in certain ways more like Christie? But I think what Christie and Trump have in common, besides common interests, is this tough, at times authoritarian side. But it's very hard for Christie to justify this. I thought George Stephanopoulos on ABC yesterday in 11 minutes really did a very good job of demolishing Christie's support simply by throwing at Christie in a very calm way all the things that Christie had said about Donald Trump as recently as a few weeks ago. So I think Christie's not playing for electoral office in New Jersey right now. I think he's playing for something else later on. If this thing goes on, which it could right to the end, one of the final primaries are in California and New Jersey, the final big primaries. And it's going to be fascinating to see how Christie's endorsement plays out in his home state, because Christie's not terribly popular in his home state right now.
Indeed. You know, your own newspaper, we have like 10 seconds left. Your own newspaper this morning, the Post, says the GOP race has gone into the gutter. Rubio has chosen to do, you know, a sort of hatchet job on Trump the way Trump's been doing a hatchet job on him. I'm sorry, I can already give you 10 seconds. What should the Democratic posture towards Trump be? How should Mrs. Clinton handle Trump?
I don't think she should go into the gutter this way. I think it's I can't believe this will serve Rubio well in the long run. I think she's got plenty of ammunition. And what she's saying is in her victory speech in South Carolina, we need to be together rather than apart. She quoted 1 Corinthians and talked about love. It's a really sharp alternative message to Trump's. And I'm going to be very curious to see how she develops that.
Yeah, interesting. All right. Well, terrific to have you on the show this morning. And congratulations on the book, E.J. Dionne.
Oh, I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
E.J. Dionne is a syndicated columnist with The Washington Post, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a professor at Georgetown University. His latest opus is a very interesting and important book. It's called Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. We've got a link to more information on our website, WYPR.org/Maryland Morning. NPR will have complete coverage of Super Tuesday tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, which, of course, we will carry for you right here on WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. It's Monday morning here on Maryland Morning. That means it's time for our weekly theater review. That's coming right up. Stay with us. Antigone. It's Greek to me, but not to Maryland Morning theater critic J. Wynn Russick. She's been to Columbia's Rep Stage to see the Antigone Project, a reinterpretation of the Greek classic by 5 women playwrights. She tells us they couldn't be more up to date.
Plays by women make up the entire season at Columbia's Rep Stage. You can see the work of 5 cutting-edge women playwrights in one night in Antigone Project, a play in 5 parts. An exhilarating, updated look at Sophocles' tragedy. Antigone Project revisits the 5th century BC character who remains one of the most liberated women in dramatic literature. Joseph W. Rich's smart, fluid direction moves the action swiftly from one short play to another. His wordless prologue introduces characters and establishes tone. And designer James Fauchard's war zone set becomes locations ranging from a surfer's beach to the underworld. A quick refresher. Antigone is one of 4 offspring of Oedipus's incestuous marriage to his mother. After Antigone's 2 brothers kill each other in battle, her uncle, the king, forbids her to bury the brother who led the rebels. But Antigone puts duty to her brother ahead of duty to her country. She's determined to bury him, even though it will mean her own death. The strongest work, Chiori Miyagawa's Red Again, takes place mostly in the underworld after the double suicide of Antigone and her fiancé. Antigone's brother has been killed by police as a result of racial profiling. Back among the living, Antigone's sister is being relocated to Treblinka. Shannon L. Graham gives a wrenching portrayal of this frightened young woman, whose anguished speeches also mention Bosnia, Cambodia, Rwanda, and Afghanistan. That's a lot of references for a brief play, but Red Again paints a devastating picture of man's continuing barbarity. And there's an unexpected hopeful note at the end. In Tanya Barfield's moving play, Medallion, an African-American laundress portrayed with implacable determination by Kelly Renee Armstrong, visits the office of Jonathan Farrar's stern white general at the end of World War I. Her brother died a hero, but she has nothing to memorialize him, not his body, not even a medal.
Give me my brother's body.
I beg your pardon?
Give me my brother's body.
Remove yourself from my office.
The cold.
Immediately. If you do not remove yourself from my office, I will have you forcefully removed.
My brother served in New York's 369th National Guard Regiment. He played in the regimental band. He died at Champaign-Marne. Please give me his body.
Antigone and Sister Ismene lounge on a beach ogling surfers in Karen Hartman's Hang Ten. But it's no day at the beach. They're under constant surveillance. As in Sophocles, Ismene plays it safe and urges rebellious Antigone to do the same. Ismene just wants to marry, settle down, and forget her dysfunctional family.
I'm not ashamed of my past. Okay, I'm ashamed. But I think that when I have the kids and a little security, my house is nice, but ever since we've been invaded and placed under house arrest, it's been a lot less cozy. When I have some security regarding this regime, when I line up my offspring with just the initials of those nasty people related to us, I'm going to feel soothed.
The other two contributions are less effective. Set during a museum tour, Antigone Arc by Caridad Savitch has some clever elements, but it's overwhelmed by its busy multimedia approach. Lynn Nottage chooses modern-day Africa for A Stone's Throw. She changes Antigone's crime to adultery, punishable by stoning. It's a tragically topical issue, but too tangential to its source. Antigone Project was conceived in response to the 2001 Patriot Act, seen by many as infringing individual rights. It's an issue resurfacing again now in the Apple FBI privacy dispute. If that's not timely enough, at one point a character makes the papal-like recommendation, build a bridge, not a wall. Further proof of the immediacy of these five modern takes on an ancient Greek tragedy, splendidly rendered at Rep Stage.
The Antigone Project is at Rep Stage in Columbia until Sunday. More on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick will be back next Monday with her review of Wild Oats at the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break for the news, the filmmaker Alan Moore on his new documentary about men working at being men. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
On 88.1, it is Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. The filmmaker Alan Moore has been the director of photography on several Ken Burns films, including The Civil War, Baseball, and The Roosevelts, an intimate history. He teaches filmmaking at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and on Friday, he will screen his latest project. It's a documentary that he's made with Leo Horrigan. It's called Out of Our Heads, A Male Journey into the Heart. It's a very personal project for both men. Leo Horrigan is a facilitator, and Alan Moore is a participant in something called the Men's Wisdom Council. It's a group of men who meet at a camp regularly to explore often complicated and troubling issues in their lives, using the support and empathy of their fellow participants to help them work through those problems. Welcome to you both. Good morning.
Thank you, Tom.
So, Leo Horrigan, this is part of something called the Mythopoetic Men's Movement. What is that?
Well, it kind of grew. I'm no expert on the history, but I can tell you that back in the 80s, Robert Bly and some other luminaries started bringing men together to talk about, you know, their lives, their inner lives is one of the phrases you hear a lot. And, you know, that kind of faded in some ways, but a lot of men really got jazzed about this idea of, first of all, getting together in male community and just exploring that inner life. And so a lot of that has survived. A lot of the, you know, work that started then has survived. So this is, in a sense, a part of that. We use myth and we use poetry to kind of drive our work.
Mm-hmm. And Alan, you've done movies on all sorts of subjects, all across the spectrum. How did you get involved in this project?
Well, it was really actually a great experience. I met Leo producing, together we produced another film for Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. And while we were on the road shooting, it was during June of 2010, Leo kept saying, well, this has been a great experience learning filmmaking from you, Alan, but I'm missing something I do every year. And then he would tell me about this group of men at the Men's Wisdom Council. And I was totally fascinated by wanting to try it out myself. So the next year, Leo and I followed him up to the camp where we have this retreat. And I was completely blown away by the experience. Then we thought, hey, we're here together. We're filmmakers now. What about inviting ourselves to the group the next summer and see if we could gain the trust of the men to document the experience?
We have a clip from the movie. Early on in the movie, one of the participants says that folks are brought there to this camp, brought there by their wounds. And it's an intensive week of, and he describes it as a tribal week. Here are some various clips of some of the participants and some of the issues that they're dealing with.
So one man might come in with grief, another man might come in with sadness, another man might come in with just rage for being violated.
And so many times they've buried that so deeply that it is too big to unearth on their own. And what we do here is we create a container where a man can let it out and let it be witnessed by a community and held in a non-judgmental way.
So if you were to do a piece of work, some release of emotion that you've been carrying probably far too long, what kind of work would you do here?
Deal with my disappointment.
Very difficult for me to tell her I love her.
A very superficial relationship.
I grieve towards my mom.
My anger towards my father.
I've kept this secret for too long.
Lack of commitment and passion.
My inability to bring my whole self to the relationships.
I have a talking to with my ego.
Family secrets.
Sexually abusing me.
Left in the crib just to scream and cry for hours.
Always misrepresented my father.
His emotional punching bag.
Everything I did was not enough.
So, Leo Horgan, one of the reasons I want to talk to you about this movie is that I may be your target demographic for this, because I must admit I am highly skeptical of this. I mean, very skeptical mm-hmm. of sure. Any salubrious result from getting together and doing this. There's a bunch of older white guys. There's candles, there's poetry, there's burning fires and hugging and rituals. How, in your experience, how does it work? Why is it effective?
Well, let me start by saying I think I would have had all the same skepticism before I went to this the first time, which was in 2001. And I think the only reason I went was because I didn't do what I normally do, which was to research something to death before I try something new. So I went because a friend that I trusted recommended it. And, you know, it has all these trappings that, you know, we have maybe attached, you know, cliches to or stereotypes to. But really what's happening, the most important things happening at the retreat are happening on the inside. They're not, it's not the candles or the, you know, the other accoutrement. It's more like what's happening on the inside of the person. And, you know, the clip you just heard, a lot of that sounds really heavy and it might sound very scary and people might not want to be part of it. But one of the things I notice about the retreats is, if you look at a man's face on the first day of the retreat and the last day of the retreat, it's amazing how different they look. And I think it's because when you clear away all that heavy stuff that's maybe weighing on our hearts, what you do is actually open some space for joy to come into a man's heart instead of him being feeling that weight and feeling all alone. Because I think a lot of what happens for men there is that they actually see that they're not alone in sure. their feelings.
Alan, yeah.
One other thing, though, it's really important. I felt the same skepticism the first time I entered the group, but it's a safe container. It's a very important, you know, concept that you have to embrace, that you're there with all the same emotions that all these other men are feeling and carrying, but you're allowed in this special place to let it be open.
And that's my next question. It is a safe place. It is a safe container, but it's a contained, safe unique space. You go in there with cameras and microphones and then produce a movie about it. Doesn't it then automatically become very unsafe? Now they're talking about these very deep, intense personal issues, not just to the men in that group, but to anybody who's going to show up to Falvey Hall Friday night at Micah.
Well, this is also the real miracle of having trust in other people. I felt like when I participated 1 year with Leo, and all the men in the group got to know me as who I am. And they heard that I was a filmmaker, and they thought, oh, wow, this guy's got an interesting career. But we know Alan, the person. Then when we proposed to shoot the film, one of the agreements was that any footage that we shot that any of the participants did not want to have seen by the public, we would remove. And we shot for 6 days, hours and hours of video, edited down to a rough cut, presented it to all the members of the group, and only one person had one little scene that he thought we should remove. So we captured what everyone in the group really wanted to express anyway.
But did you then capture an unvarnished look at the work that the group actually does?
Yes. I think we have a very authentic documentation. I trained as an ethnographic filmmaker, and I kind of approached the experience as an ethnographer. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes through.
So, Leo, neither of you guys are psychoanalysts or social workers or counselors or anything, but I wonder why a group setting for these kinds of discussions and these kinds of, venting of your feelings as opposed to individual counseling? What do you get out of the group that you wouldn't get if you're in counseling with somebody one-on-one?
Well, Alan might have something to say about this too, but I can say that a couple of therapists have said to me that even though they do one-on-one work with people, they actually would say that group work is more effective and more powerful. There's something about being witnessed by a group that's just not the same as having a one-on-one relationship.
We're going to have to take your word for it because that's all the time we have.
Okay,
but I appreciate you guys sharing. Thanks so much for coming in. Alan Moore and Leo Horrigan, their new film is called Out of Our Heads, A Male Journey into the Heart. They're going to screen the film at the Maryland Institute College of Art on Friday night at 8 o'clock in Falvey Hall. We've got a link to more information about the movie on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That'll do it for us today. Coming up Wednesday, we continue our series of conversations with the people we'll find on the ballot in the April 26th primary election. Congressman Chris Van Hollen joins me to talk about why he thinks he should be the Democratic nominee for the U.S. Senate seat. That will open up when Senator Barbara Mikulski retires next year. And we'll also recap the results of the Super Tuesday primaries and the caucuses with Baltimore Sun Washington correspondent John Fritzy. NPR will have complete coverage of the Super Tuesday primaries tomorrow night at 8 o'clock right here on 88.1 WIPR. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.